Welcome to the Kingdom Roots podcast with Scott McKnight and Cody Matchett. Conversations designed to look at how the kingdom took root then and how it's taking root now.
Hey, Kingdom Roots listeners, Cody Matchett coming to you from Calgary, Alberta, Canada. On today's episode, Scott and I interview Dr. Nicholas Elder on his new book, Gospel Media. Dr. Nick Elder is Associate Professor of New Testament at the University of Dubuque, where he teaches undergraduate Bible and theology courses and New Testament exegesis and Greek courses in the Theological Seminary. He's the author of the book we're talking about today, Gospel Media, Reading, Writing, and Circulating Jesus Traditions with Erdmans in 2024. He's also the author of Media Matrix of Early Jewish and Christian Narrative with Bloomsbury. He's a father, a spouse of one, a home renovator, and a distance runner. And we really think that you're going to love this episode and this interview with Dr. Nicholas Elder on his excellent monograph, Gospel Media. Well, hey, Dr. Elder. Hey, Scott. Good to see you guys.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Good to see you, Cody and Nick.
It's good to be here. Well, as our listeners know from our introduction, we're here to interview Dr. Nicholas Elder today on his excellent book, Gospel Media. I saw this book, lots of shares on Twitter, and then saw it on Scott's Substack, and then got a copy myself, and I'm just delighted to get to chat to you about it in person, Dr. Elder.
Yeah, great. Thank you. I am absolutely thrilled to be here.
Well, Nicholas, we would prefer that you explain the substance of your book to our readers in your own terms rather than us try to summarize it and get responses. But I think Cody has, if I'm not mistaken, Cody has a couple introductory questions to start us off.
Yeah, I mean,
with.
I think just the basic thing, like you're saying, Scott, like I'd love to hear from you for our listeners, Dr. Elder. Kind of the main argument of the book and how it came to be.
Yeah, absolutely. So the through line of the book is that reading, writing, and publishing texts in the ancient world, and specifically in the Second Temple Jewish and the Greco-Roman context in which all of the books of the New Testament were written, and specifically the Gospels were written, all these things, reading, writing, and publishing, were complex affairs. There wasn't one way to do any of these things, just as in our present environment, there's not one way to write a text, there's not one way to read a text, there's not one way to publish a text. So what I do in the book is sort of look at the complexity of each one of these things. And there is one part of the book on reading, one part on writing, one part on publishing, or what I call circulating texts, that sort of that surveys how those things worked in the ancient world, and then attempts to apply the complexity of how those things worked to the Gospels themselves, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, making the primary argument. The primary argument or thesis of the book is that we should expect reading, writing, and circulation of the Gospels to happen in multiple different kinds of ways and not one single simple kind of way. So the sort of background to the book is my first book, which was called The Media Matrix of Early Jewish and Christian Narrative, was my dissertation from Marquette University. And it was a comparative project of the Gospel of Mark and another Second Temple Jewish narrative called Joseph and Asenath. These two texts, very, very different on almost every count, theologically, content-wise, but they have a very similar style. In that first book, I argued that both the Gospel of Mark and also Joseph and Asenath were composed similarly to one another. That is sort of from oral environments, sort of a dictation kind of situation. So that's the first book. And then this new book sort of had blossomed out of that. I wanted to take the work that I did with respect to the oral environment of Mark and then situate the other canonical Gospels within this environment, and sort of saw the other canonical Gospels as doing things a little bit differently than what Mark does.
Okay, I want you to tell me where I was wrong. In 1981 or 82, I was beginning my PhD on the Gospel of Matthew, And I had underlined my synopsis. I've underlined my whole synopsis. Uh-huh. And I had worked through a conclusion, and I was convinced that Matthew used Mark in sort of a Q hypothesis, and therefore I disagreed with the primary opponent of the day, William R. Farmer, mm-hmm. who had quite a few students, and people were really debating this. And so when I wrote my dissertation on Matthew 10, here's how I envisioned Matthew working, that he was probably sitting on his butt with his on his haunches, is what they sometimes say, with his knees spread apart, and he had a papyrus scroll of some sort spread across his legs, and he could tuck it underneath him to tighten it. I don't know where I picked up all this, but this is the conclusion I had, and that he had the Gospel of Mark and maybe something like a collection of sayings in a cylinder, like a tube, that had a spike at the bottom that he could punch into the ground, and then he could pull it out and read it, and then put it back in, and so that Matthew, in a sense, didn't have a screen up here where he could copy from Mark. He had to read it and then sort of remember it and then write it. And one of the interesting things that I saw over and over, it's not foolproof, is that as Matthew got toward the end of passages from Mark, he condensed and got less, he wasn't copying quite as tightly as he had been at the beginning. Okay, so that was sort of how I worked it. And my professor, James D.G. Dunn, he liked this. He liked this idea. And my external examiner liked it as well. And that was G.N. Stanton, who was no slouch in Matthew
no,
studies.
Indeed.
And John Muddyman was another reader, but I don't think what I remember John Muddyman saying to me is that I didn't make any mistakes with Greek accents, which evidently really mattered, and I was really glad of that. So how am I wrong? How would you respond to that sort of hypothesis? And seriously, I don't care what you say. My dissertation was never published. Graham Stanton asked me half a dozen times to publish it, and I had moved on. I was ready to do something else.
Why don't we start with what's right in that image? Because I think there's a lot that's right in there. I myself am. Well, let's take it a step back. Areas were right. I think right Matthew sort of the posture of writing on one's leg rather than writing on a table. You know, that seems pretty on par with the best we know about the mechanics of actually writing on papyrus or on parchment. The fact of having a source open before one seems quite legitimate. The primary thing that sort of jumps out to me about what is probably wrong about that is I would maybe imagine more people in the room with Matthew. That we like to think of our gospel authors as individualized authors, but texts are always the products of communities. And I don't say that necessarily to suggest that Matthew is the figurehead for a community, but texts are communal social projects that they multiple minds, multiple hands, multiple mouths, multiple ears are involved in the creation of any text. So, and when you put more people into the room when writing is happening, the more you can imagine is being brought in to the process of composition. I think I would now imagine Matthew with multiple people, multiple scribes, multiple laborers in the room with him at different times. You know, they're probably coming and going. I also imagine Matthew and his team probably doing a lot of excerpting on things like wax tablets, that they are working draft-wise. And they're not just, Matthew's not just writing on his leg the final copy that's going to become Matthew, but he's writing portions in draft mode. And the probably most normal mode for doing drafts would have been on multiple sets of wax tablets. So the big way that I would amend our mental image here is let's get more people into the room.
Yeah. Well, I also, and I think you're probably right. When I was writing my dissertation, it really wasn't Matthew's community that was involved. Most people were thinking of Matthew as a redactionist, redacting Mark, as an individual. So we were only talking about Matthew, a lot less about his community. I think once Andy Overman and Warren Carter got involved in Matthew studies, this stuff started changing rather dramatically. But I was in the days of Jack Dean Kingsbury, and just after the famous German redaction critics had been writing. So that's helpful. But I also think that my mistake was to think that Matthew wrote this text for someone to read, pretty much sitting there reading the text themselves rather than reading aloud, which I would guess that you think is a part of it. I don't want to hog all the questions. Cody had,
no, it's good.
Had some
maybe we can stop there for a second, though, Scott, because I'd like to pause here, because, you know, one of the things that you do really well throughout the book is you continue to remind us that media, as you're saying now, emerges from social contexts. So I think you've kind of hit on that there's a social context from which, but thinking about the Gospels as media, so maybe a couple of terms would be helpful before we move forward, because you cover these at the beginning, and you're clear about them, so I want to be clear with our audiences too. You use media, and then you talk about the paratext or the paratextual material that sets up the Gospels, and then the myth, because the myths play a big role, what you mean by myth. So if you want to perhaps riff on those just for a moment to get us set up as we then get into some of the myths, and then we highlight the ways in which you see the Gospels as doing different things on account of those paratextual materials.
Yeah, thank you. That's a fantastic question. And I will note that the book, I wanted to put this at the beginning of the book, publishers who know more about these things, speaking of texts being communal projects, publishers who know more about these things decided it's better at the back. It's a natural place for a glossary to be. So I do have a glossary of terms, because I use terms in a sort of specific way in the book. So there's a sort of glossary of terms in the back of the book where I sort of define how I am particularly using these terms. So let's take them sort of in order, starting with media, which is the plural form of medium. And so a medium is a conduit for experiencing a discourse, such as a speech, a note, a book, a codex, or a roll. So the idea is that a medium is a way to sort of communicate or to transfer human thought from one person to another. So a speech is a certain medium. A writing is a certain medium. And so it's ultimately about sort of how thought is experienced from sender to receiver. Let's see, our other ones are paratext. And sorry, what was remind me what the third one,
Just myth. Because you go through the myths, but you want to be clear that there's always truth in
that. Yeah, that's right. Let's go to paratext. Paratext is anything that sort of, and I'm thinking textually here, paratext. Paratext is the stuff around a text. And the stuff around a text can be in the book itself. So you can think of footnotes as paratextual features. You can think of a glossary as a paratextual feature, a table of contents as a paratextual feature, but can extend even beyond the physical book itself. So a paratext can be an author's commentary on the book. You know, this podcast that our listeners are hearing right now is in a way a paratext of my book, Gospel Media. So paratexts sort of extend outward to, in some ways, infinite degrees. Anything that's sort of about the text and alters the reader's experience of it in some form or fashion. And then lastly, and perhaps most importantly, defining myth. I don't use myth in the book to mean false. What I use the term myth in sort of the classical sense as something that shapes an understanding or a worldview and is oftentimes left sort of unscrutinized. That is to say, they are things that structure our thought in a sometimes unconscious way, or we are not aware that we think these things. They are assumptions that sort of lay dormant. So one of the things I do in the book is each chapter progresses by initially offering a media myth and then sort of correcting that myth with a reality, a media reality. So it's sort of a contrast of what we often think versus probably what is more the more complex on the ground stuff of what's happening in the ancient world.
I'm reading Dale Allison's Constructing Jesus right now, and I've known Dale since we're about the same age, and so we've known one another our entire careers. And he is a master at tossing dust in the eyes of people who think they see something. And I think this is the genius of your book, is that simplistic myths are blown apart. Mm. You've tossed dust in the eyes of things like, the texts were always read aloud. It was an oral culture, but some people read privately. And that texts were usually engaged as communal events. Well, not always. And each gospel was written to be experienced the same way. Well, not always. That persons in the ancient world did not compose texts in their own hands. Now, that one I would assume to be the case with the Apostle Paul, but I don't think I've ever thought about whether, I guess I have assumed that Matthew and Luke probably could write themselves, but it's not all that clear. That composition always involves dictation and that it froze an oral discourse. That's not true always. The Gospels were all written using the same compositional practices. That when you toss dust in the eyes. Texts were distributed. This is what I think. Some of the most fantastic stuff you talk about is how texts were distributed in the ancient world.
Yeah.
So that's what those myths, I think you have said to people, let's just not make simple assumptions about all these texts, how they work.
Yeah. I appreciate those comments. And I'll say I was sort of tossing dust in my own eyes because essentially each one of these myths are things that I thought and believed. And then I would come across primary texts that sort of made me question these. I'm like, wait a second, this doesn't sort of jive with what I've been told, what I thought. Mm-hmm. And so it became a process of collecting the primary texts every time I would sort of encounter something that ran against the grain of what I was taught and what I thought, to the point where I had a sort of preponderance of evidence against many of the things that I myself had previously assumed.
Yeah, it's really helpful.
Oh, that's
I'm
good.
I'm wondering maybe if we could hit each of those one at a time in brief, and then we can come to each of the Gospels and the distinctions you make about the Gospels themselves, because I know that those become really helpful ways to think about the bigger arguments you're making. So Scott listed all the myths here, but talk to us a little bit about reading in the ancient world, perhaps. What are some assumptions we make that are wrong? And what are some of the ways that you are, I think, you know, rightly throwing dust in our eyes or inviting us to have a little bit more nuance when it comes to the way ancient peoples read?
Yeah. So part one of the book is three chapters that all engage reading in some form or fashion. So the first one, and I think probably one of the most prominent myths that is most easily debunked, is that reading was always or usually allowed. That people in the ancient world, whenever they picked up a text, they read it out loud, that they did not read silently. The reality, and there is just an overabundance of textual evidence mm-hmm. indicating that people that had the ability to read, so we're presuming reading literacy, but those that had the ability to read read silently and aloud. That actually, in fact, the ability to read aloud psychologically first presumes the ability to read silently. That we have to look ahead in a text reading silently to be able to vocalize those words out loud. So we find all over the place in the ancient world, people are reading silently. So authors are assuming that people read silently. They're in narratives, they're depicting people reading silently. And it's just a fact of the ancient world that people could and did read silently. Sort of corollary to the myth that reading was always or usually allowed is a myth that texts were usually engaged in communal reading events. I think we buy into this one a lot in gospel scholarship, that when a gospel was read, it happened with a gathered community. But once again, if people are reading silently, they're reading silently by themselves. That people read in solitary environments. People read in small groups. That is, two people, three people, four people. They read in sort of moderately sized groups, maybe five to 15, and they read in large groups. That we have all kinds of different reading events. And by the way, all of this is also true of our modern world. You know, that that reading in the modern context, we sort of often associate with individualized reading. But of course, we read texts aloud to our children, with our families, in church contexts, in conference settings. So we do the very same things, that there are different sizes and there are different sort of social group contexts for reading events. So all of those first two, they sort of engage, apart from the Gospels, how people are reading. And then so chapter three, which is the concluding chapter to part one, engages the Gospels. And the myth in that chapter is that each Gospel was written to be experienced the same way, that Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John, someone picks them up, they would have experienced each one of them the same way. When in fact, each individual Gospel, that is to say, the Gospel of Mark at one time could be experienced one way and at another time be experienced another way. We can imagine someone reading the Gospel of Mark silently to themselves. We can also imagine someone reading the Gospel of Mark to a gathered community. But one of the arguments I make in that chapter is that each individual Gospel sort of has a sort of most natural reading event for it. That Mark works sort of as sort of an oral performative thing. So, you know, we've got people like Dr. Phil Ruge Jones, who still gives fantastic performances of the Gospel of Mark from memory, and it really works as a performance. You can watch him perform the Gospel of Mark over an hour and a half and be absolutely captivated by it. I don't think the same thing works for something like the Gospel of Matthew or Luke, that you're gonna have a longer event, you're gonna get bored, but the mind's gonna wander maybe a little bit more. Matthew and Luke and John also, they just don't move as quickly as Mark does, but they work really well for individualized reading in a way that maybe Mark isn't sort of primed for in the same kind of way. So while each of the four Gospels can be experienced different kinds of ways in different settings, also each Gospel sort of makes for, has its own natural reading context or event.
It's pretty good.
Yeah, it's very good. And then so then in part two of the book, then, as Scott mentioned with the myths, you come to writing practices, which, of course, relate to reading practices. So talk to us maybe a little bit in broad strokes what you're doing there and then how that relates even to what you just said about we think about Mark as Evangelion or Gospel. We think of Matthew as Biblos or, book,
yep.
I suppose, so to speak, for studying. And then Luke has this individualized reader perhaps in mind, and then John is doing his own document thing later. But talk to us about then the writing practices that go along with this.
Yeah, great. Yeah, absolutely. So part two also consists of three chapters. Chapter four is writing by hand. Chapter five is writing by mouth. Chapter six is writing the Gospels. So what I'm really trying to do is sort of across this and these three chapters is to, again, complexify how we think about writing, the mechanics of writing in the ancient world, and to suggest that there are multiple different ways to write a text and multiple different things sort of go into the process of composition. That composition isn't just someone sitting down, writing on parchment with their hand, making a final draft from start to finish in one go. That there are a whole lot of layers to this. And again, much like our modern compositional context, you think about writing a sermon, writing a book, writing an article, whatever it might be, there's a whole lot that goes on sort of under the water of it all, that goes unseen, that you don't see in the final product. So chapter four, writing by hand, sort of debunks the myth that persons in antiquity did not compose in their own hands, that people absolutely did, that handwriting was important in the compositional product, in the compositional process, even if the final product may not have been wholly written in the author's hand. But sometimes they were. We have many, many primary source texts that say this text was written in this person's hand. So we do have occasions where a final product is written in an author's hand, but also just sort of in the sort of rough draft stage of creating documents, handwriting would have played an important role. That composition in the ancient world wasn't necessarily dictation all the way down, which is sort of what I address in chapter 5 then, writing by mouth, the myth that composition always involved dictation, which was an act of freezing an oral discourse in written form. So we very often think of writing in the ancient world as dictating to a scribe, and that scribe taking down exactly what is said by the author. In reality, dictation or writing by mouth took a variety of different forms, that someone could write very closely what was spoken, but we also have sort of examples of free paraphrase, lots of different ways of writing by mouth, that there's not one form of dictation. And then writing the Gospels, I sort of take these two things together and say, if handwriting and writing by mouth both played a role in compositional processes, is there any way that we can sort of tease out how this might have worked out with respect to the Gospels? And as you mentioned, Cody, I make much in chapter 6, which is titled Writing the Gospels, about what the Gospels say about themselves. So each gospel gives itself a label. This happens for Matthew, Mark, and Luke at their very beginnings, sometimes in their very first words. So Mark calls itself, and I take these beginning words as the titles for Mark and Matthew. But Mark calls itself a gospel, a euangelion, which pretty unambiguously had oral connotations in Mark's context. So Mark's innovation, in my view, is to take something oral, a euangelion, orally proclaimed good news, and put it into written form. So that Mark is absolutely a written document, but it is representative of an oral tradition and an oral process that stands behind it. And this is why I think oral tellings or oral performances of Mark still work really well today. Matthew, in contrast, and you know, presuming Matthew is looking at a copy of Mark in Dr. McKnight's sort of imagined model for Matthew 10, he sees gospel as the first word of Mark and says, no, that's not what I'm doing. I'm not doing orally proclaimed news. I'm writing a biblos, a book or scripture. And what I found as I looked to the Second Temple Jewish context of this particular term is that guys like Philo and Josephus, When they use this word, they do very, very consistently for Israel's scriptures. So I think when Matthew calls itself, the book of the Genesis of Jesus Christ, it has high aims for itself. It's really positioning itself as on par with Jewish scripture. And so there in that section, I sort of invoke some of the very good work of Dr. Chris Keith. He'll talk about competitive textualization, where Matthew is sort of like it's priming itself to compete, and compete doesn't necessarily need to be antagonistic. Priming itself to compete with maybe another pre-existent gospel like Mark, but also with Jewish scriptures in order to be read alongside of Jewish scriptures. Then Luke addresses itself to an individual, a guy named Theophilus. I look at a number of Greco-Roman texts, especially from the physician Galen, who writes to individuals. And when he writes to individuals, it seems like he really has that individual in mind as his first reader. So I take Luke's address to Theophilus very seriously and think that Theophilus was in fact Luke's first reader, that Luke is first and foremost written for a single individual reader, even if Luke has in mind his text getting out to a wider audience after that. And then finally, John does not indicate what it is at the beginning of the Gospel of John. Of course, it starts with a beautiful prologue, but at the end it calls itself a biblion, which is a slightly different word than biblos, which is what Matthew calls itself in Matthew 1:1. And biblion is a little bit more generic in my view. It's more like a document. And where John calls itself a biblion is at the end in the so-called colophons, where it's sort of saying, hey, there are other Jesus documents out there. This document that you have just engaged is sort of one amongst many, and there could be many, many more. You know, there are this is John 21 here. That so many more things about Jesus could be written to an infinite degree. So there, I think John is sort of situating itself within an environment where there already are written documents about Jesus that come in different forms. And that John is sort of nondescript, saying, hey, I'm throwing another document into this Sea of Jesus traditions.
I have one little brief comment and then a question for you. When I was thinking about doing a PhD, one of the places I applied was the University of Chicago. And I sat in a class by Hans-Dieter Betz on Matthew. And he begins the day by saying, Matthew is not a gospel, and he has a great German accent. It's a biblos, and he was adamant, and I thought, I've just been reading all these books on genre, and they're all saying these are gospels. I don't know what to do, but he was, so he was moving in the direction you are. But here's the question. How do these four, let's just say, the oral tradition of Mark, the Evangelion, and I like your idea there, and then the biblos, genesos of Matthew, and Luke's clear writing for Theophilus, and then John's biblion, how do these connect to the genre of a bios? Yeah. And I'm thinking of Helen Bond's pretty informative study of Mark as the first gospel, biography of Jesus. How do these connect to bios or to the genre of a biography?
Yeah. So in some ways, I want to differentiate between the genre of bios and the media forms here. So I think just as and this is where I think the relationship is. And I should say that I am convinced enough that bioi is the best sort of generic category for all four of the canonical gospels. If we're looking for comparanda, that's going to be our best bet. But at the same time, I just reviewed a really great book, a collection of essays by Achilles Breitenbach called The Gospel of Mark as an Episodic Narrative. And he's going to actually pretty strongly push back, not against Dr. Bond particularly, because these essays are all written before her excellent book was published. But he sees the Gospel of Mark in some ways as a little bit more loose, that once we start to get things that are formerly bios or bioi, that things get sort of tightened up a little bit as far as the literariness of it. And so when I look at something like Matthew and Luke, I do see that literary tightness. I think this makes a whole lot of sense as a bios. When it comes to Mark, I, again, not anti-Mark as bios, but I'm still open to other possibilities, as it were. But all this to say, I think the question of media and genre are different to me. Whereas, so we can think of in sort of our modern context, we can have romantic comedy as the genre, what might be equivalent to the bios, and the different forms of the romantic comedy as different media. So, you know, you can have a romantic comedy in the form of film, the form of television, the form of a book or a novel, that the way that you experience those things are a little bit different from one another. And I think that's also true of the Gospels, and that we get a tightening up or a more close relationship to the genre of biography as the Synoptic Gospels are recast, as Mark is recast in the form of Matthew and Luke, that we get a more tight association with the bios. And I think a Greco-Roman reader would look at something like Matthew and Luke and more quickly think biography as to form and function than they might with the Gospel of Mark.
Morten Jensen, the Danish scholar, just has a brand new monograph out. My review of it just appeared in RBL for SBL. And he thinks the word gospel is quite significant. And he has probed it as an epic-making announcement that is connected to Isaiah.
Yes, yep.
So, yeah, I think this is going to be a significant study on the meaning of gospel. But I think Richard Burridge would like your distinction between genre and form. Form and content, they're gonna play on different lines. So I think that's a really good answer. I know Cody wanted to continue with the other myths.
That was really helpful. I was reading your book, looking over at this last week, and my wife is a therapist. She doesn't read the kinds of things that maybe we read, and she saw me reading the chapter Writing by Mouth, and she said, "What are you reading?" Writing by mouth. She couldn't place this turn of phrase. Yeah, so your last kind of section of myth busting, if you will, throwing dust in our eyes, to use Scott's analogy, is the way the Gospels were circulated as medias. And they were not all written to be circulated the same way, and there's distinctive features about that. Can you tell our listeners about
that? Yeah, absolutely. So one of the sort of common models that biblical scholarship has a sort of inherited from the field of classics is this idea of a concentric circles model. And this comes primarily from what is the very good work of Raymond Starr, where he sort of presents this ideal model of how literature got out there, how literature circulated. And it starts with an author sort of sharing it with a very small select group of friends. And then as the text sort of goes out wider and wider, it gets shared wider and wider. And sort of gains more influence, it gains more readers until it sort of gets out there into the public. But what we find, and so that's sort of the myth that we have bought into as biblical scholars. And certainly some texts do get out there that way. So again, it is to say the myth is not necessarily wrong, but things are more complicated on the ground. And the more complicated reality on the ground is that texts and discourses get out there in all different kinds of ways. Sometimes they get out there because they're leaked ahead of time. Sometimes they get out there because they're copied by a student and sort of, and then they make their way to other people and get passed around, even if they weren't intended to be published. So we have all different kinds of modes of publication. And here I would be remiss if I did not mention the very, very good work of Dr. Matthew Larson on this, who has done a whole lot of work on accidental and unintentional publication, that texts get out there on accident. I suggest that texts get out a whole bunch of different ways, and we should expect the same thing to be true of the gospel. So then part three, only contains two chapters, one on publication and circulation, where I sort of outline the diversity of ways that texts get out there, and then chapter 8 applies that to the Gospels themselves. And I suggest that the Gospels would have gotten out there in different kinds of ways, but particularly when we think of the physical form of the Gospels, we ought to be thinking of different physical forms. We don't need to think of one physical format, whether it be codex or roll. And these are our sort of two main options in the first century. Some people would sort of quibble or debate whether or not the codex would be a primary option for literature in the first century. That may not be a live option or a prominent option until, you know, maybe third century or so. But I imagine, and I make the argument, that we should imagine the Gospels circulating textually in different kinds of ways and in different kinds of physical forms. So what we find when we look at the primary literature is that sort of workaday texts were more likely to exist in codex form. And so I think something like the Gospel of Mark, which is maybe a little bit more rough and ready, is more likely to exist in codex form than is something like Matthew and Luke. And that, so then if Matthew and Luke are actually taking what once existed as sort of like a, you know, a rough and ready text and putting it into the roll form, changing the physical medium of the text, that is a way to position the gospel tradition as more literary. So I often talk about in these chapters and also in the chapters in part two of writing the Gospels about Matthew and Luke having this sort of literaturization project when it comes to Mark. They want to make Mark more properly literature. So they'll fix things about the style and the language. They tie up the loose ends to make it a little bit tighter.
Okay, one of the questions that we ask in gospel studies, and I was so thrilled that you read Joseph Kürzinger, because I thought I was one of the only people in the world who had read Kürzinger's book. You start reading, I thought it was very helpful at the time. What is the relationship between Mark and Peter, and what was this like at the beginning? And because I think you have some really good insights.
Yeah. So I think we need to start with the fact that that Papias presents Mark and Peter as in, you know, close relationship to one another. So the testimony is Mark is sort of Peter's follower, and he writes up the things that Peter taught. But he doesn't do so sort of in order or with taxis is the Greek term there. And so that sort of Papias wants to say that Mark can be forgiven for the way it progresses, for its style, because of the nature of the thing that he was doing. So it's, you know, it's still, of course, openly a historical connection, how closely the Gospel of Mark relates to Peter's oral teachings. You know, do we have Peter's words in the Gospel of Mark is certainly an open debate. But what I think is very interesting about this testimony is that the situation that Papias presents is sort of historically plausible. So whether or not Peter and Mark have this really close connection and the Gospel of Mark is really a record of Peter's oral teaching, I'm interested in that, but I'm more interested in the fact that Papias presents as plausible the fact that someone might have been going around teaching things about Jesus, telling the stories about Jesus in an oral form, and then someone sort of wrote those oral traditions up, put them into a narrative form. And I think what Kürzinger's work does is it sort of really gives us more space for seeing that scenario as quite plausible, that Mark is actually, has a foot in sort of the oral life world of these traditions about Jesus.
That's really helpful. I'm at a different phase than both of you. I'm just a lowly PhD student. And, you know, one of the things I think about often is the work that I'm doing and the things that I'm writing, you know, that analogy of like sitting down at a table and making a couple of comments and hope that, you know, they're important enough to be a part of the conversation in some way. I guess I wonder for our listeners, and we have a lot of listeners who are pastors in churches, and I wonder maybe for them, you know, with the key things that your book is saying and the arguments that it's making, how do you hope it helps direct the conversation in ways? What do you hope comes from this book as its own form of media that gets out into the world and hopefully can trickle to pastors and academics alike and have a kind of influence? What are you hoping for there?
Yeah, that's a great question. So on the academic level, you know, I hope that we sort of recognize the complexity of reading, writing, and circulation of Jesus traditions, like that we stop sort of bandying about these myths that I've tried to debunk. But maybe on a more pastoral and theological level, I hope that the book sort of opens the idea of the Bible and Scripture as multimedia in form. That is to say that it's not simply the words collected in a bound volume, but that Scripture is proclaimed. You know, it's the word of the Lord. It becomes the word of the Lord as it's proclaimed in a setting, but it becomes the the word of the Lord as proclaimed in lots of different settings, you know, in the reading of scripture, in church, and its proclamation and preaching, and its individualized reading and sort of reading in familial settings, that we stand in a long line of tradition of narratives and words and teachings of Jesus existing in multimedia, in a multimedia environment. And sort of, we're not new in that way, that this was the case in the ancient world, and it's been the case. We can sort of draw a line from the first century context in which the Gospels were first written and then read, all the way up to today, where we've always had sort of multimedia experiences of Jesus traditions.
Thank you for your work. It's I hope that our listeners will pick up a copy and read it and engage with the arguments. I guess maybe we can end with, I know I mentioned in the bumper, and I know you mentioned an article that's coming out later this year on Philemon, but maybe what are you working on now? What are you researching? What are you thinking about? And maybe what's the soundtrack? I just know this from following you on Twitter, but what's the soundtrack maybe that's forming the background for your work right now? What are you listening to as you're working?
Oh man, that's a great question. So yes, I am. Last year was working on an article length project on Philemon, the claim in Philemon. Paul, as he does elsewhere, says, "I wrote this in my own hand." But I make the argument that the entirety of Philemon is written in Paul's hand, that the sort of norm for writing a personal letter was to write in your own hand. And if you didn't, you offered an excuse about it.
Forgive me, for our listeners, Scott just hit himself over the head when Dr. Alder said that. He just didn't, yeah.
Yeah, so, and this is sort of previewing what I'm moving into research-wise in the next year or so, is to expand some of the work, some of the ideas that I've done in gospel media to the Apostle Paul. So I'm working on a book that is tentatively titled right now, Paul Among the Literati, where I'm sort of situating Paul between the high literary figures, you know, the Ciceros, the Plinys of the ancient world, and you know, the business folk, like what it would take to run the literacy it would take to run a business in the ancient world, because running a business requires a whole bunch of skill sets and a whole bunch of literary skill sets that we often overlook, and I think these are reflected in the Pauline corpus. So that's where I'm going right now. What the soundtrack to that book will be is still an open question. The soundtrack to this book was an album by a band called Taco Cat, one of my favorite bands, and also by Margot and the Nuclear So and So, another album by Margot and the Nuclear So and So's. Right now, it's a steady dose of let's see, what am I listening to? Waxahachie has a new album that just came out. I mean, Beyonce's album just dropped, so you know, Beyonce's in my ears a lot right these days. But what the album or what the playlist for this next book will be, still to be determined.
I love it. Well, thank you again for being with us, Dr. Alder. It's just been a privilege to get to chat to you about your book and to sort of open up with this media avenue to our listeners the great work that you've done. So thank you so much.
Great. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm.